Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From the Sun Lake Splash, Planting Tips for the Crazy July Heat by Danette Hummel. Remember, monsoon season is on its way, and many of our desert plants love the added humidity, but it will get windy and can deplete the soil and flower beds. A good thing to do in July is add iron to your soil, and if you can stand it, this is a good time to add manure so it will bake into the soil, making it rich and ready for fall planting. Manure helps soil resist wind erosion by binding loose particles together and keeps it from blowing away in possible upcoming windy weather. If you haven't already, now is a good time to plant Lantana, a valley staple, Vincas, colorful and able to handle triple digits, Palms, Zinnias, vibrant colors, native to Mexico, perfect for Phoenix, and Gomphrena, clover-like, globe-shaped, long-lasting flowers, thrives in intense heat, and lastly, most succulents. Plant during the evening or early morning and water lightly. Afterwards, apply some sort of a shade cloth for the first couple of days until the plants adjust to sun. A simple idea, staple half of an old pillowcase onto two thin dowel bars and plant in the ground over the new plants. Water in the early morning or after sunset, and do so deeply around the plants directly into the soil, keeping water off the actual plants so they won't burn or bear too much weight. Also, spreading some mulch, straw, wood chips, or compost will retain moisture, keeping plants cooler. Placing broken pieces of wet, unglazed clay in the dirt will allow a slow release of moisture to the roots. But if using broken clay, be sure to use gloves. The next time you boil pasta, steam veggies, or boil some eggs, don't pour the water down the drain. Let it cool and pour over your plants, both outdoors and indoors. The water will have useful nutrients such as calcium to keep the struggling plants healthy, strong, and green. Watch for small pests as they are desperately seeking water this time of year as well. And as always, make sure someone knows you're working in the yard. Wear a hat, sunscreen, and stay hydrated, drinking plain water and electrolytes. From SouthwestGardener.com, July, What to Do in the Desert Garden by Deanne Albin. In the desert southwest, July means the arrival of monsoon storms, which brings higher humidity and much-needed rain. Discover what gardening activities you should and shouldn't do, and things to watch out for during this changeable month. July in the Southwest Garden is a month of changes. The monsoon officially begins June 15th, but the first rains usually arrive in early July. You may or may not find the monsoon season thrilling. I'm one of those desert dwellers who loves this time of year. Monsoon storms bring welcome rainfall, humidity, and cloud cover, all a great relief for your plants. But it's not all good news for gardeners. Monsoon storms can bring flooding, hail, dust storms, and damaging wind. And an increase in moisture leads to more insect pests, plant diseases, and weeds. At some years, the monsoon is a nonsoon that brings the wind, but very little rain. All these changes mean there are changes in gardening tasks this month as well. Here's the July weather outlook. While the average temperature doesn't change much from June to July, the average humidity and rainfall increase considerably. This may feel less comfortable for you, but your plants will love it. Here's a look at July weather averages in both Tucson and Phoenix. For Tucson, high temperature averages around 100 degrees Fahrenheit, low temperature 75. Precipitation just slightly under 2.5 inches, relative humidity 40%. UV index 11.2, wind 15 miles an hour. In Phoenix, high temperature averages 107 degrees Fahrenheit, low temperature 84. Precipitation just slightly under 1 inch, relative humidity 27%, UV index 10.3, and the wind 8 miles an hour. What to do in the garden in July? July is a pretty quiet month in the garden since it's not time to plant, prune, or fertilize. However, you need to continue to keep your plants hydrated, protect them from too much sun, and watch for pests. Continue to be prepared for heat waves and be ready for storms and subsequent storm damage. Here's a snapshot of the activities you can do this month and those you should stop doing. You want to sow summer wildflower seeds, water, fertilize potted plants, watch for iron chlorosis, watch for pests and weeds, and prepare for storms. Don't plant most plants, don't prune most plants, and don't fertilize most plants. What you can plant in July, but should you? Well, July is not a good time to plant desert landscape plants. Most plants will be much happier when planted in the fall, and there will be less work and worry for you, too. I find nursing new plants through the summer to be a stress I'd rather avoid. Some landscape professionals contend that during the monsoon, with its rain and higher humidity, is a good time to plant native and deciduous trees, palms, and summer flowering shrubs such as Texas Ranger or Lantana. However, I consider this a gamble since some years the monsoon is a dud that brings little heat relief and little to no rain. Heat-loving cactus and succulents can be planted or transplanted now, but it's not ideal. If you do, cover them with shade cloth for the duration of the summer to prevent sun scald, especially if they're from a nursery or you don't know their current orientation. But if you get the urge to grow something new, sow some summer wildflower seeds, which germinate in response to the monsoon rains. Try to get them in the ground before the rains begin. These plants grow fast and will bloom this summer. Here are some places that sell and ship desert wildflower seeds, including monsoon seed mixes, which contain favorites such as Arizona poppy, blanket flower, and desert zinnia. You can also start sunflowers from seed now. You can choose between growing wild sunflowers or one of the many sunflower cultivars. Summer watering tips. You can continue to water on the same schedule that you used in June. However, when or if the summer rains come, you can skip the next scheduled watering anytime you receive a half an inch of rain or more. Having a rain gauge is invaluable for keeping track of your rainfall. I've tried many types of rain gauges throughout my decades of gardening. Glass and plastic will crack from freezes, uncommon, or hail, common. The past few years, I relied on this silicone rain gauge, which has held up to all types of weather, including severe hailstorms. If you don't have a rain gauge, you can check rainfall totals near you at the University of Arizona's rainlog.org. This is especially helpful if you live around Tucson, where most of the data is collected, and somewhat helpful if you live elsewhere in Arizona. If you live in Maricopa County, check out the county's rainfall data page. Most potted annuals need watering daily. If you're watering any plant with a hose, always check the water temperature first. Water from a hose can be hot enough to damage your plants, especially if you water later in the day. Assured cool water is one of the many reasons the best time of day to water is in the morning. And while you've got your hose out, if you haven't had any rain for a while, give your plants a quick shower to remove poor clogging dust and prevent dust-loving spider mites. If you haven't already done so, give your irrigation system a good once-over. This is especially important if you travel during the summer. Irrigation system problems tend to crop up when you go out of town. Ask me how I know this. With monsoon storms come power outages. If you experience a power outage, check your irrigation controller and reset if needed. Besides collecting water in my rain barrel, once the humidity goes up, I also collect AC condensate, an overlooked source of free gray water. Learn more about collecting and using AC condensate water here. Next, what to fertilize. Desert landscape plants should not be fertilized in July. It further stresses plants by encouraging new growth, which is easily burned by the intense summer sun. The exception is potted plants. Most potted plants benefit from a dilute solution of fertilizer every 2 weeks during the summer. Watch for iron chlorosis. Iron deficiency sometimes shows up in the summer. The telltale sign of iron chlorosis is yellow leaves with distinctly green veins. Desert soils contain iron, but it's in a form that some plants can't use, leading to deficiency. Iron chlorosis is especially common in non-native plants such as citrus, hibiscus, bottle brush, and gardenia. Native plants have developed ways to absorb the iron they need from alkaline soils. If you have any plants showing signs of iron chlorosis, now is a good time to treat them. Learn how in this article, Why Desert Plants Get Iron Chlorosis and What to Do. What to prune? While it's okay to remove any damaged branches from trees and shrubs, July generally is not a good time to prune. Pruning further stresses your plants by exposing new areas to the sun and stimulating new growth. However, it's not a bad time to prune native trees such as mesquites and Palo Verdes. They may drop some sap, but heal quickly during the hot weather. If you have trees with heavy canopies and you are concerned about storm damage, please have an arborist trim your trees, not a guy with a truck and a chainsaw. Deadheading spent flowers, especially annuals and potted plants, encourages new flowers and is a nice but not necessary activity in summer heat. Don't feel obligated if you'd rather not work in the heat. Watch for garden pests. An increase in moisture leads to an increase in insects, plant diseases, and weeds. Watch for insect infestations on plants. Plants that have been stressed by heat and drought, or that have been overwatered, are more likely to harbor insect pests. Some of the most common insect pests you may notice on your landscape plants this month include ants, aphids, cochineal, crickets, hornworms, leaf roller moth caterpillars, mosquitoes, Palo Verde borers, and spider mites. Check around your yard for standing water that could harbor mosquitoes. Empty any pots, saucers, buckets, or any other forgotten nooks that hold water after rains. If you have standing water you can't empty, add mosquito bits, which will kill their larvae. If you collect rainwater, keep it covered. If you notice a cochineal scale infestation on your prickly pear cactus, hit it with a hard spray of water. That should be all you need to get it under control. Yellow bells are subject to damage from Tachoma leaf roller moth caterpillars, which skeletonize the leaves. If you have an otherwise healthy plant, consider coexisting with them. They turn into moths that are important pollinators and food source for other wildlife. The damage they cause is temporary and only cosmetic. If you feel the air overwhelming your shrub, prune off the worst areas or use the jet spray on your hose to dislodge them. Spraying insecticides, soap, or BT is largely ineffective since the caterpillars are tightly wrapped in leaves and protective webbing. From the Chicago Tribune, hostas are easy care and long-lived, and they bloom, by Beth Botts. Do you notice when your hostas bloom? Hostas often don't get credit for being flowering perennials, but that's what they are, said Sharon Usla, plant knowledge specialist in the plant clinic at the Morton Arboretum in Lyle. Sometime between June to September, depending on the species and variety, a hosta plant will send up a tall stalk that opens into a cluster of bell-shaped blooms in shades from white to purple, which add a particular charm to the summer garden. Most gardeners choose hostas not for their flowers, but for their foliage, a tidy tuft of leaves that lasts all season. They are shade-tolerant, winter-hardy, easy-going, resilient plants that can live for decades. That's one reason they are good companions for trees. If you plant hostas around a tree, it will likely be the last time you need to disturb that tree's roots for a long time, Usla said. The hostas will thrive in the shade, and the roots of the tree's roots will coexist quite happily. The Arboretum's ground cover garden shows off the effect with sweeps of hostas below basswoods and other mature trees. Unlike many creeping ground covers, hostas do not spread and are not known to become invasive. Given their popularity, it's not surprising that more than 11,000 cultivated varieties of hosta have been developed from a handful of species native to East Asia. Hostas may have leaves that are broad and rounded or narrow and spear-shaped, deeply veined, wavy-edged, or crinkled, and any shade of green from pine dark to blue-green to startling chartreuse. They come in a wide range of sizes. When you have an awkward space in your yard, like a few square feet between the steps and the sidewalk, a hosta of just the right size can be an easy way to fill it, she said. A single, shady garden may contain the demure blue mouse ears, less than a foot wide, with little purple flowers in July, and the commanding Empress Wu, 6 feet wide and 3 feet high, with leaves more than a foot long and tall stalks of lavender blooms. Blue-tinted hostas, like both of these varieties, actually have a waxy coating on their green leaves that absorb certain light frequencies to make them appear blue. Blue hostas often turn more green toward September as the wax wears off or melts away in summer heat. Varieties in plain green or chartreuse hues are better for sites in part sun, although hostas in general are not full sun plants. Gardeners may face a problem when a tree is pruned or removed, throwing the hostas it once shaded into full sun that soon scorches them. The best solution is to transplant those hostas into a shadier area, Usla said. In general, hostas are easy to care for. They appreciate soil rich in organic matter, but they need no fertilizing. Like all perennials, they need to be watered when the soil feels dry an inch or two below the surface. It's best to water them at soil level. The broad, overlapping leaves of a large hosta can intercept water droplets like an umbrella, so water from a sprinkler or light rain may not reach the soil where it could soak down to the roots. Water that lingers on leaves through the night can also encourage disease. In moist, shady gardens, slugs that nibble hosta leaves can be a problem. Simply remove the damaged leaves at the base. Hostas also are not a good choice where deer are present. They are deer candy, she said. After the week or two of their bloom, the tall flower stalks, called scapes, will dry on the plant. For a tidier look, snip each scape off at the base or just above a leaf, and the mound of leaves will remain handsome until it is killed by frost. Hostas are so widely planted that it's easy to take them for granted, Isla said. The time when they bloom is an opportunity to appreciate them a little more. From the Arizona Republic, can rabbits ruin a home? Why this Arizona homeowner says yes, by Tiffany Acosta. Some homeowners deal with pest problems that feel impossible to solve. In Yuma, that problem isn't insects, it's rabbits. Gail Hancock, a homeowner who has lived in her house for more than 50 years, says what began as just a few escaped pet rabbits has turned into a full-scale infestation. Speaking with Yuma Sun, she explained that the issue started about 4 years ago when a neighbor's rabbits got loose after a fencing problem. Since then, the population has exploded. She said the rabbits have caused extensive damage to her property. They've dug numerous holes throughout her yard, one so large she described it as looking like a bear cave. They are chewing through wiring, getting into vents, and even contributing to structural issues like cracks forming in her walls. I can't enjoy my backyard anymore, Hancock told the Yuma Sun. My dog can't go outside unless I go with her on a leash. According to Lori Franklin, public affairs sergeant at Yuma Police Department, the situation is complicated and in part self-sustaining. We've been dealing with her for 4 years, Franklin said, adding that the problem is she is feeding these rabbits. And because she's feeding them, they're happy and they're multiplying. So kind of like feral cats, she is feeding the feral rabbits now, and yeah, they are not going to go away because she's feeding them. Franklin added that multiple attempts have been made to help reduce the population, including coordinating with a rescue organization, but the efforts ultimately fell apart due to issues between Hancock and the organization. The Humane Society of Yuma does not have the capacity to remove all the bunnies and can take 2 animals a month or those that are injured. How to get bunnies to leave your yard? If you're trying to get rabbits to leave your yard, the key is making the space less appealing to them. Start by removing what attracts them, trimming dense bushes or tall grass where they can hide, and cleaning up any food sources like fallen fruit or accessible garden plants. You can also install fencing around vulnerable areas. It should be buried a few inches into the ground since rabbits are good diggers. Covering gaps under decks, sheds, and vents helps prevent them from nesting. Repellents can also help. Commercial rabbit repellents or natural options like strong-smelling substances such as garlic or certain predator scents can discourage them, though they often need to be reapplied regularly. Motion-activated sprinklers or lights can startle them as well, but consistency matters. Here's another article that appeared recently in the Arizona Republic by Tiffany Acosta. Think ticks aren't a worry in Arizona? You're wrong. Where they live. Ticks are tiny, blood-feeding arachnids, more closely related to spiders than insects, and despite their size, they can carry a big reputation. These hitchhiking pests latch onto animals and people, feeding on blood and sometimes transmitting diseases such as Lyme disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. According to the CDC, tick-borne illnesses have been increasing for years, and warmer temperatures are one factor helping ticks expand into new areas and remain active for longer periods of the year. In fact, CDC data show tick-related emergency room visits and tick-borne disease reports have climbed significantly since 2017, as changing weather patterns create more favorable conditions for ticks in many parts of the country. So is that bad news for Arizona, the hottest state in the nation? Maybe, or maybe not. While warmer temperatures can help ticks survive and spread in some regions, Arizona's extreme desert heat can also work against them. Ticks need moisture to survive, and triple-digit temperatures combined with very low humidity can be tough on many species. That said, Arizona is not tick-free. Ticks can still be found in higher elevations, shaded areas, neighborhoods, hiking trails, anywhere wildlife or pets roam. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories each week from the terrific book, Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called Lilacs for Mother's Day. It was written by Ken Weber. And there's a quote here from Ann Landers. The true measure of an individual is how he treats a person who can do him absolutely no good. Lilacs for Mother's Day. The family had just moved to Rhode Island, and the young woman was feeling homesick that Sunday. It was Mother's Day, and her own mother was 800 miles away in Ohio. She had called home that morning to say Happy Mother's Day. Her mother had mentioned how cheery and colorful the yard was now that spring had arrived. And as they talked, the young woman could almost smell the tantalizing aroma of the purple flowers hanging on the big lilac bush just outside her mother's door. Later, when she told her husband how she missed those lilacs, he popped right up from his chair. Let's go get some. I know where we can find all you want. Get the kids and come on. So, off they went, driving into the sparkling May countryside, up past the small villages and new housing developments, past the abandoned apple orchards, back to where trees and brush have devoured old homesteads. Where they stopped, dense thickets of cedars and junipers crowded the roadway on both sides. There wasn't a lilac bush in sight. Come with me, said the man. Right over that hill is an old cellar hole from somebody's farm of years ago, and there are lilacs all around it. I know the man who owns this land, and he said I could poke around here any time. I'm sure he won't mind if we pick a few lilacs. Before they got halfway up the hill, the fragrance of the lilacs drifted down to them, and the kids started running. Soon, the mother was so excited she, too, began running, and when she reached the top, she stopped in amazement. There, far from view of passing motorists, were towering lilac bushes, so laden with the huge cone-shaped flower clusters they almost bent double. Smiling with delight, the woman ran to the nearest bush and buried her face in the flowers, drinking in the fragrance and the memories it recalled. While the man examined the cellar hole and tried to explain to the children what the house must have looked like and where the fields were, the woman slowly drifted among the lilacs. Carefully, she chose a branch here, another one there, and clipped them with her husband's pocket knife. She was in no hurry, relishing each blossom as if it were a rare and delicate treasure. Finally, though, they climbed back over the hill and returned to their car for the drive home. For miles, while the kids chattered and the man drove, the woman sat in silence, surrounded by her flowers. Her smile was now one of contentment, and in her eyes was a faraway look. When they were within 3 miles of home, she suddenly shouted to her husband, "Stop the car! Stop right here!" The man slammed on the brakes. Before he could ask why she wanted to stop, the woman was out of the car and hurrying up a grassy slope with boughs of lilacs. At the top of the hill was a nursing home. Because it was such a beautiful spring day, many patients were outdoors strolling with relatives or sitting on the porch. The young woman went straight to the end of the porch, where an elderly lady was sitting in her wheelchair, alone, head bowed. Across the railing went the flowers, into the lap of the old woman. She lifted her head and smiled. For a few moments, the two women chatted, both aglow with happiness, and then the young woman turned and ran back to her family. As the car pulled away, the woman in the wheelchair waved and clutched the lilacs to her bosom. Inside the car, the kids asked, "Mom, who was that? Why did you give her our flowers? Is she somebody's mother?" The mother said no, she didn't know the old woman. She'd never seen her before. But it was Mother's Day, and she seemed so alone, and who wouldn't be cheered by flowers? And besides, she added, I have all of you, and I still have my mother, even if she is far away. That woman needed those flowers more than I did. Well, that satisfied the kids, but not the husband. The next day, he purchased half a dozen young lilac bushes and planted them around their yard. And several times since then, he has added some more. I know. I was that man. The young mother was and is my wife. And now, every May, our own yard is fragrant with lilacs. And every Mother's Day, our kids gather purple bouquets for their mother, just as she gathered them that first year. And every year I remember that smile on a lonely old woman's face and the kindness that put it there. That's called Lilacs for Mother's Day, written by Ken Weber, one of the many stories that make up chicken soup for the gardener's soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy, and we'll be talking with you soon.